David O'Connor. David, thanks so much for this.
No problem. Thanks for having me on. I don't know about the intro thing, but I don't know about the legend part. So.
You're being very modest. You're certainly a perfect candidate, and I thank our friend Leslie Knopf for suggesting we reach out to you. I was really touched and saddened by the death of Catherine Morrell over the weekend in Florida,
as we all know.
Yeah, no doubt. Her thoroughbred mount off of Northlands carry on what is known as a rotational fall. And it just occurred to me, David, that a conversation would be worthwhile about the pressures that the equine sport world is under and how you're dealing with it. And it's a topic that is really close to, you know, to you. It's really the role you've taken on in recent years.
Yeah, there's no question that's been, it's something that is very, very important to me. You know, I had a great career, 25 years, and got to take me places, and you want to have that opportunity for other people to do the same thing. And the risk management is, it's a huge part of it. And risk management, we gallop horses, we totally believe, as I think everybody does in the horse world, that these horses have such great lives, being able to do what they do. And in my sport, they enjoy the sport. You can't make them do it. There's absolutely no way you can make a horse absolutely do what they do. They enjoy it and all that kind of stuff. And so when you have something that is tragic, it's very disturbing, very upsetting to everybody. And we have had, programs over the last 20 years that have really been looking into this from a number of different things, how people get qualified, how they get educated, how a horse gets qualified. So there's very, very specific things in the national programs and international programs about how people are allowed to play the sport. You have to go qualify for every level that you go up. So when a tragic accident happens, we all have to go back and look at it, like, how did this person get to where they were? How did that situation happen? What was the fence construction that we have? And was it in the modern way of thinking? So all of those pieces of the puzzle, there's no one magic bullet you could say, there's your answer. It's a myriad of things. There's 10 different things, or more. And so it really goes back and makes you look at that program of how that person got to that point, and a mistake was made and a price that is too high was paid for a horse and rider.
How closely do you watch what racing, what particularly the thoroughbred racing industry is dealing with acutely the last year in particular, but certainly, and this is not limited to the United States. I've had this conversation with Nick Luck about what has gone on regarding the Grand National and pressures, same kind of thing. I mean, how are those? I mean, let's the animal activist types. I mean, how much scrutiny has eventing been under, or are you at all?
No, there's a lot of scrutiny, and fun enough, we invite it in. We have conversations all the time with even animal activists, humane societies. We bring them into the conversation because I think that's very, very important. And when I was on the American Horse Council a long time ago, we were talking about racing when the Eight Bells situation was going on. We talked about it. I think you have to bring the Humane Society, and you might not like what they hear, but you're gonna hear it, and you're gonna be in a place where you can have a conversation. And I think that's very important to open up and have this conversation out front. And our situation is completely about the reduction of horse falling. Which has been, and the efforts that we've taken here in this last 15 years, we've halved the number of horse falls that there are, and halved the number of rotational by the actions that we took. So there's positive stuff like that, but still one tragedy is too much. I mean, it's one, it's just heartrending. And so I do believe that the conversations have to be open, and the conversations have to be invited in. Some of them are very uncomfortable, but you have to hear it, especially in the modern-day world where the so much of the situation has changed from an urban, society away from rural societies. Or mm-hmm. if you think about 100 years ago, everybody saw a horse every day. Every day you would have yep. seen a horse, because it would have been in a city, it would have been on a farm, it would have been, pulling wagons, it would have been in New York City, it would have been Baltimore, it would have been wherever. And now we have a lot of people that would never seen a horse, well, hardly ever, except for maybe on TV. And so the attitude is different. Those of us that stay in the agrarian side and the rural side, we're still believe in what that animals are such a huge, important part of our lives. We play games with them, and which I think they enjoy. I think their livelihoods are great. But we have to do everything that we can to make sure that the risk management or the risk is as low as possible. And you can't make life, you can't make it safer than life itself, but you have to make sure that you're doing everything you can. And our directive is about reducing horse fault. That's the thing in eventing. And these programs we put in the last 15 years, which is anywhere from construction to fence construction to qualifications and education and all of these things, they all point to that one thing about the reduction of horse falls. Because if a horse doesn't fall, people don't get hurt. Or they get minorly hurt. That somebody just falls off, they might bruise themselves, they might even break a collarbone or something like that. But if a horse falls, the risk goes way up. And I personally just hate horse falls. I just hate them. And so you're trying to do everything you can in your education to prevent horse falls. That's our goal. And so following racing, obviously we follow racing a lot. I mean, I enjoy racing. I enjoy watching racing. But I think the one thing that we talk about is that we have to invite the people that, the fans, we have to invite the people that are not that for it, and invite them into the circle and invite them to have that conversation, and we come up with a play forward. That's my view.
Well, and that's interesting because, certainly the eventing world, you had a period, and I was at a Rolex where three horses were lost. So this is not a freak occurrence. I mean, having what happened to Catherine and Carry On, there's incidents. I mean, you guys have incidents, and they're just as tragic as when, we lose, and we lost a jockey in Arizona this weekend as well. But I'm intrigued that you feel that, that having the biggest critics at close at hand is a viable approach to, I don't want to say placate, but I mean the thing.
Oh, no.
Right? I mean, we're trying to do the same kinds of things in terms of improving the environment, but it seems like there's no satisfaction, David, with the critics. And granted, we're the racing industry is a more high profile, I suppose, and under more mainstream media scrutiny than. Than the equestrian world.
Yeah, I mean, the sport world's gotten big, but no question, the racing, with everything that's involved, governmental involvement, the financial involvement that you guys have, everything is, in state-run, state corporation commissions that are, involved in running the sport or in guarding the sport. I think those are huge, but I do believe in an appropriate setting. I mean, I'm talking about having it out in, in the middle of a parking lot, but I think in an appropriate setting that people are coming to a table in a logical way and voicing concerns. And you have to hear those concerns, and you have to listen to those concerns, because at some point, the public is going to have a say in it. You're selling a ticket, Well, as soon as you sell a ticket, and it's not your own private little sport that you are doing it in your backyard, as soon as you sell a ticket for somebody, well, you've got to listen to what the person wants to see. And what do they want to do? And what is their part of their entertainment? I believe horse falls are, something in our world that is, that's our main objective, because none of us, the riders, owners, fans, we don't want to see a horse fall. I don't mind somebody falling off, but I don't want to see a horse fall. And so the whole that becomes the focal point. And I think it's really, really important for everybody to have their say and then make a plan forward about how you're going to go. I don't think anybody wants eventing to go away. Nobody wants racing to go away. But are there things that we can do? Are we doing everything that we can to make sure that we are having a sport that's enjoyable to watch and enjoyable for all the players that are in it, and, you know, financially successful enough that it's going to be ongoing? I mean, those are real conversations.
No, and I thought that your perspective would be invaluable, and especially given, your mission of trying to, affect whatever changes are necessary to, have the environment be as safe as possible. One of the things that's amazing to me is the kind of comments. I mean, usually, when there's a tragedy involving horses, certainly on our side, you've got people that rush in and have, such a hypercritical reaction. And very much so. And I don't know why they think that those of us that are participants in thoroughbred racing, that we're callous about it, because we're not. But I'm amazed, David, at how forgiving and how understanding and how, touched for Catherine's family and for Carry On the reactions have been. I read through, I mean, there's I think close to 300 comments on a Yahoo Sports article about the incident, and they're just overwhelmingly understanding about the dangers of eventing, and it's actually a very highbrow discussion, which is unusual in itself on the internet in terms of reactions. And it's just to me, it was just amazing, compared to what we deal with in a similar scenario.
Yeah, I think one of the things that you're always making sure when you go, the first reactions are obviously very emotional, because it's a very emotional time. It's a very heartfelt, emotional reaction time. But if you don't step back and look at the problems and look at the issues, you could actually spend all of your time and you're fixing the wrong thing. You're not working on the thing that is actually going to make a difference, whatever that thing is. We are putting a whole much more effort, even worldwide, more on the coaching side of the equation, because not just fence construction and things like that, but how does somebody get educated to be able to do this, and the skill set base that we have. And so you have to make sure you're targeting the things that are going to be effective, because you could, off of an emotional reaction, you could go off in a direction and, that actually doesn't make it doesn't have the effect that you're looking for. And so the stepping back and trying to be logical about it and trying to really ask the hard questions, I think is very, very important. And there's a lot of people, there's a lot of views. That needs a lot of views. It needs a lot of people putting their views forward, and then, then a smaller group correlating through it to be able to say, okay, well, this has the ability to have an effect. This might not have some other issue might not have the effect. And so we're going to pick this line, and we're going to pick this line of thinking because we think that this is the most effective thing for reducing risk. That's true with any, if you talk about airlines, if you talk about car manufacturers, we use this thing that, it's a famous model called the Swiss cheese model. Is that I collect, if you take four pieces of Swiss cheese and everyone's got holes in it and the holes don't line up, you could have something minor happen. But when, for some reason, those holes all line up in all of the four or five different pieces, then that accident happens. So these four or five different pieces, how do we make that hole smaller so that the holes don't line up to have that one accident? And is it, in our world, is it construction? Is it education? Is it qualifications? Is it course design? These are all things that have to have the ability to have an effect, and you have to step back away from it to be able to be logical enough to say, okay, these are issues, and these are the things that we think that can make an effect of these changes that we've proposed, and then keep monitoring.
One thing you didn't mention in there, it is scrutiny of the athlete themselves, and of course for us, that's
absolutely
become. Yeah, that's become paramount in terms of medication and judging, viability for competition, soundness, et cetera.
Yes, I mean, we're very, very strong on the veterinary side with our equine athlete. International rules say there's no, there's a no medication side of the, the rules that go to the sport. That's, that's what the FEI does. We also, we have jogs in all of our disciplines in the international world, they're seen by veterinarians, jog perfect, and out in public, in front, everybody jogs, they're accepted, and that also gets done at the longer competitions. That gets done, again, during the competition, after the cross country, those horses are looked at again, in public, jogged in front of everybody. That care of the athlete is a huge, important part of what we do, right? And it's part of our history, and it's gotten even stronger. And it's a very, very public environment that these horses are looked at.
It just occurs to me to bring up yesterday's news from the Breeders' Cup that is adopting six of the suggestions from Dr. Bramlage, coming out of the Mongolian groom tragedy, and among them was very specific and more detailed trot evaluation and very specific jog and certainly pre-race examinations at every level of the sport now includes vets in the morning watching a horse essentially just jog down a paved road watching for any signs of lameness. And that part of it, the pre-race inspection seems like and also evaluating horses, David, that are coming in already at risk. And you don't deal with this as much as racing does, but being able to identify what might be a horse that is more susceptible to injury. Catastrophic or not, coming in.
And we actually, the way that we look at it, yes, we do our pre-competition tests, and then we do one in the middle of the competition, because we're over 3 days, because our sport is like a triathlon, so between the second and third phase, we have another jog in the international competitions. The national competitions where the stress is not as high, we don't do that, I will say, so to be upfront. And I think looking at them is absolutely huge. And then we also, in our qualifications, a lot of times slow somebody down. So that let's say if you're qualifying for a bigger championship, there's a timeline when you have to get that done by. It's either for the smaller championships, 14 days out, larger championships, 21 days out, so that you end up having this time to make sure that the horses are not overrun and they're not run back to back to back to back to back. And especially in our longer competitions where the horse is put under, the gallop longer, we actually do regulate a little bit the times between how many times that horse can run within a time period.
Which begs a question, actually. When, particularly for Olympics and the Pan Am Games and for the biggest events on a calendar, whether they're every 4 years, every 2 years, annual, there's got to be tremendous pressure. I mean, when you have a horse come off somehow, or we deal with things like abscesses and hooves and so forth. That's got to be a real problem. Do you? I don't even know the answer to this. do you have a backup horse as you're pointing for targets?
Well, you know, when you do one of these big championships like the Olympic Games and all that good stuff, if you're lucky enough and you got, you know, you're qualified on multiple horses and you have, you're in a place where you got selected, you know, by your country on multiple horses, you know, and I had that happen in my career where I actually got selected on three horses and I had to pick either the one or two that got to go. You know, that's a great bonus to have happen, because I know even in my first Olympic Games, I didn't go to my first Olympic Games because the week before my horse went lame.
There you go.
And, you know, that's a bad day. Believe me, that's a bad day.
Wow.
But it happens, right? Because you don't get to, you know, you don't get to play again for 4 years. So, so that is a very real part of the sport. And, you know, each national federation, the rules are quite strong about national federations, you know, entering horses that are competent and qualified to go. Nobody wants to not finish the competition, because if you don't finish the competition at the Olympic Games, you let your country down. So there's, that's very, very strident, but it's a hard day. And that's a hard life to live in when, as any athlete, football, you know, you watch on football every weekend, and I love football, right? When I watch football every weekend, I see someone's career end every Sunday. Every Sunday. And college sports, right? You watch the same thing. You watch somebody's career end on every Saturday or every Sunday, and that is true in any sport that happens. You know, and sport is a hard life. There's no question. It's hard and it is unforgiving in that aspect. You know, of where your dreams are off of one road, and then suddenly, you know. Always like that country song says, right? You know, you hear God laugh when you tell him in your dreams. You know, because they get taken away real quick, and that's sport. I don't think it's just equestrian sport. I think it's sport as a whole.
David O'Connor has been kind enough to join us, the 2000 Sydney Olympic gold medal winner in individual eventing, part of team gold medal wins at the Pan Am Games and at the World Championships, and one of the most respected authorities on safety in the world of eventing. And David, I'm just thrilled to have had the chance. I wanted to get some perspective, and you know, and as somebody, you know, speaking for racing, please extend our sympathies to the Morels. Catherine's passing. Just too sad. And it just seemed like she was as dedicated, like everybody is in that sport, and she had a willing partner, it appears, in this off the track thoroughbred and Carry On.
There's no question. This is a life, you know, and not just a sport. This is a life, and a life that we all choose. And when we lose one of our own horses or human, it just rips our heart out. There's no question. And you just keep going back over what could it. Are we missing something? Can we do more? Is there more to do? As I said, there's conversations going on about how people get there, but this is, we're fully committed into, making changes if changes need to happen, being hard on ourselves about it, because it is just too gut-wrenching to go through.
Racing people dealing with the same
Absolutely.
Elements,
Absolutely.
They're parallels. David, thank you so much for this.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Not at all. David O'Connor, the gold medal winner at the Sydney Games for the United States. Grew up in and around dressage and three-day eventing from the D.C. area. And I wasn't going to, when he talked about how much he enjoyed football, I wasn't going to give him the business about the Redskins. But I really am thrilled to have had a chance to. Reading that story, Sunday about Catherine Morell and her death and the off the track thoroughbred Carry On with her. And I saw this gracious reaction from that side of equestrian sport. I just thought it was a conversation worth having. Let's take a break. Seth Merrow closes out the morning.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Want an online tournament that boasts no rake, skim, or takeout with a $10,000 first prize? Here it is. Play ExpressBet Live online Saturday, March 21st. ExpressBet Live is for account holders only, with no registration or other pesky fees. Simply make a live $20 wager on one horse in 10 competition races. Earn the most and collect $10,000. Plus, there's from $1,000 to $4,000 in additional prizes. The top 30 finishers automatically qualify for the $50,000 ExpressBet Showdown. Sweep the card and earn a juicy $5,000 bonus. Don't have an ExpressBet account? Visit ExpressBet.com today and qualify for a $100 bonus. Then register free for ExpressBet Live, the best tournament value going. Play live online with ExpressBet Saturday, March 21st, and it could be your day, but only if you play. Account wagering is not permitted in all states. National Public Gambling Support Line, 1-800-522-4700.
145 over 92.
180 over 111.
182 over 100. And I had a heart attack and a cardiac arrest. And then a stroke.
Your blood pressure numbers could change your life.
A lot of people don't understand, including myself, I didn't, now I do, the impact of having a stroke.
My memory is shot.
When I woke up, I couldn't speak.
If I would have followed a treatment plan, I would not be in this situation.
It's a tough journey.
Lowering your high blood pressure could save you from a heart attack or stroke. If you've stopped your treatment plan, restart it, or talk to your doctor about creating one that works better for you. Start taking the right steps at manageyourbp.org.
It's a new life, but I'm going to make it better. I'll come back. Ask your doctor, check your blood pressure.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
From BRL Equine, the people that bring you EPO Equine, Unlock, and Bleeder Shield, now comes Flexify HA, the most advanced scientifically based joint supplement on the market. To find out more, contact me, Joseph Vellante, at 215-501-6880. To be the best, give them only the best. BRL Equine.
We're back at the races. About 20 minutes to noon here in the East. And not far away, Seth Merrow joins us from Capital OTB, Equidaily. Seth Merrow, what another introduction is necessary?
Were you off getting a donut or something? Because that bumper music lasted a long time.
I like this. No, I actually was sitting here. This is fairly new, and the Kills, and I just like it. So that's why I let it go a little bit.
All right, that counts.
Don't get like Andy and give me a hard time about the length of the length of our play-ins. him and Zito constantly complaining.
No, normally it's kind of I would say a standard when I sit here, and I don't mind listening, but this one went a little longer. So I mean, you do it out of your house, so you can certainly, I can certainly understand. Hey, I'm going to go grab a donut, and you come back, and it's time for me to go on now.
Well, I don't do the production out of the house. I just do the talking out of the house.
But that's what I'm saying. You come back and the music's still going.
Oh, I see. Well, once in a while. There has been the occasion where Casey, Deja's on the board today. But, there's been the occasion where Casey will send me a text. If I see a text, Steve, ? That's when I have to run down. When I run downstairs, there's been the occasional UPS or FedEx delivery that has drawn me downstairs. I always come back laughing and out of breath. Used to be when I smoked. When I smoked, JJ used to make fun of me. He said I was the only guy that could smoke a whole cigarette in 2 minutes.
I don't think I knew you were a smoker.
You know what? You probably never really, as it happens, the anniversary, very curiously, I quit smoking on a leap day 12 years ago. Yeah.
Oh, was it just cold turkey, boom, and you were out?
I utilized the gum. I used the Nicorette gum. And what's funny about it is, I just always assumed, the gum. How can the gum work? How could that? So I had actually quit using, there was a pill, and I tried the patch. The pill had worked actually pretty good. And I'd stopped smoking for like 8 months at one point. And then I started again. And then of course, when I lived in Montreal, you had to smoke. You sign a form. You can't live there if you don't smoke. So in Montreal, I had to smoke and smoke Des Mauriers. But then with Tina, Tina, as Tina says all the time, Seth, she's responsible for me.
You know, that's funny you bring that up. Last night I was doing some little spring cleaning in the apartment, and I came past a big thing of ties that were just sitting on a chair. So I hung them up, but literally like 3/4 of rear tie that I have inherited at this point. But I started thinking, and they were kind of nice ties, but I was thinking, now, is that your choice, your taste, or is that Tina's taste?
They're all my, she certainly has picked out ties, whether we're together or sometimes something shows up that she bought online. But I can't have this discussion in front of her too much. But I did work for Hart, Schaffner & Marx. My first serious job was working for Wallach's, the men's clothing store, for Hart, Schaffner & Marx, and I was a haberdash salesman specifically. I was in the shirt and tie department. When you're before they move you into suits, you start out with the ties and shirts and helping the accessorize, so I've got I got a pretty good pedigree on this front. I Tina makes it seem like I was walking around blind without a cane. I mean, Jesus.
Well, it was the late great Vic Zest who dubbed you the Bull Brummel of Saratoga.
He did. Vic always got a kick out of my apparel.
And I must say, I wait every summer for the blue suede shoes.
I'm going to need new ones, actually. I had my most recent pair. That or I got to find a new cobbler because my guy.
Oh, man, are they even a thing anymore?
Well, yeah. Cobbler?
Yeah, I mean, you can get shoes repaired still? I would assume probably there are, but it used to be fairly common. I remember as a kid, there was a shoe repair store right on Main Street in Amsterdam. But you don't see that anymore.
Well, the guy I've been going to for years, he passed away in Bennington. You know, it's funny. Bennington is, I don't know, a city of what? 100,000 maybe? 70, 80,000, 90? I don't know. How big is Bennington?
That's a good question. That sounded like a lot to me, but I have no idea really.
It's a good sized town. In downtown Bennington, there were two cobblers, three storefronts away from each other. It's like, you got to be kidding me. I mean, it's one thing. You got one guy on the east side of town, and then you got another guy on the west side. These guys were three doors down from each other, and somehow they were surviving for years and years. And then one retired, and then the other one died. So now there's none. So I got to find a new cobbler.
Yeah, I can't help you there. Like I said, I wasn't even sure they were.
You can't help me. What are you kidding? You're a guy that wears those Rockports, those sneakers that are designed to look like a man's shoe. Like, you can't help me. That's the funniest thing I ever heard. The last pair of leather shoes you owned were Stride Rights at about age six.
I go for comfort. I do have legitimate shoes, though. There are those occasions where you have to put on the legits. So I probably have three pairs.
I've got three pairs of Cordovan. You're unbelievable. He's got three pairs. That's great.
I'm going for the comfort over the style.
Well, if you've got three pairs, that means you've got a black, a traditional brown, yeah, and a Cordovan. I'm at least respectful of that.
I got black and two browns.
all right. As long as you got a light brown and a dark brown,
I think they're both dark brown. I think, yeah, I don't have light brown to me is bad. That's way too. You're going. That's like the ties. Until you handed me the first sack of ties, I don't think I had anything outside of a solid color.
Yes, this is what this is. This, and of course, for those that are, for somehow, if you've somehow missed one of the great gags in all of punditry, on Loose on the Lead, one Christmas, our Christmas show, I put about 15 ties that I had retired from my rotation, and I brought them to Seth as a sack of ties. And so sack of ties has become a tradition, and Seth has to endure walking around Saratoga and the Capital District and having people say, is that a sack of ties tie?
People do. That is no joke. People do say that. I'll be wearing a tie, and hey, that comes from the sack of ties?
Sack of ties. There's Sacatoga and there's Sacatize.
And the sad thing is, most of the time I'm saying, yes, it did come from the Sacatize.
Well, and of course, people, if you want to see Seth's collection of ties, you look in the back seat of his car because they're there looking like eels feeding on guppies. They're intertwined. It's unbelievable. Unbelievable.
I just have them there, ready for use. They're quick access.
I want to thank, let me do this formally too. I want to thank Leslie Knopf for like the third time this morning. Leslie says the Del Mar Bootery in the Stuyvesant Plaza. And it's very funny because Tina and I actually discovered Stuyvesant Plaza fairly recently, and we ended up getting the bench stools, the bar stools, that we have in the new kitchen. And we got them there at the West Elm, actually, of all places, which sort of surprised us because we'd never even walked into a West Elm. And the next thing you knew, we found something that we're having a hard time finding. Thank you. And Leslie also, of course, delivered David O'Connor to us just now. And a conversation I was really eager to have.
Well, she's all purpose this morning.
Oh my God, Leslie's unbelievable. She's a conduit.
Yeah, I have not been to Stuyvesant Plaza in a long time, but they're a nice stop right at the end of the Northway there. And speaking of the new kitchen, I have to ask you. You tweeted out your power was out, but you made, and I forgot how you referred to it, like. Was it Pioneer Coffee?
Pioneer Coffee, baby.
It took me a second. Is that you just boil the water and toss in the grounds? Is that the game plan?
Oh my God! Oh my God!
I don't drink coffee, so I wouldn't know that.
Well, I will admit that I do not have a percolator, so I couldn't do it that way. What I ended up doing though was boiling. Water, then filling the carafe, and then putting it into the bun pour over. I've got a bun pour over to make the coffee, and so the hot water was still hot enough in the chamber from the power having gone out. So when I poured boiling water on top, normally you put cold water on top, and it fills the chamber, and the hot water in the chamber then goes over the grinds to make you your pot of coffee. But in this case, I went ahead and poured boiling water in, and it forces out the chamber, and there's your magical pot of coffee. So Tina thinks I'm the Wizard of Oz. And so that was tremendous. Which she also couldn't figure out, because she also said to me, well, how are you going to turn on the pilot? How, you know, because it's electronic, right? The stove, you know, the click, 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 you know, when the burner lights.
Yeah.
I said, yes, honey.
With a match?
With a match. she hadn't really, the way the flame was going to be produced. Believe me, I felt powerful. I felt like the Virginian. The Virginian meets MacGyver.
Oh, MacGyver. Yeah, there you go, MacGyver. Okay, I've got a toothpick, a paperclip, and some cellophane. I'm ready to make coffee.
I can make coffee.
Speaking of your Twitter feed, to get back to horse racing,
yes.
I was scrolling down your Twitter feed the other day, and you retweeted Fonner. I think it was Saturday at Fonner. Man, what a crowd they had. That's great to see.
Oh, that, you know, I Chris Katulak and the team at Fonner Park, and yeah, absolutely. They had a full clubhouse, people on the apron, and they were going nuts as the horses came down the stretch. Yeah,
I'd like to get out there sometime. There is one that I've never checked off the list, but it's
supposed to be
a
great.
Lot of fun, particularly looking at the as I say, the video you posted with the full facility. It looks like a lot of fun.
Got to also take the quick opportunity here because now I see where the media feeds are coming in hot and heavy. Word, as I mentioned yesterday while Jeremy was on at close to this juncture, that Kieran McLaughlin was officially retiring from training and he's going to take over Louis Saez's book. And with Richard DePass retiring. And so we'll have to certainly have a career appreciation because Kieran has had such success and longevity and, you know, not to mention the courage involved, you know, with his physical challenge that he faces daily. So applaud and very much wish Kieran success in this transition.
Yeah, absolutely, and a nice guy too. I mean, over the years, you know, I'm sure you've had him on. I've had him on a number of times. He's always very accommodating, nice guy, easy to root for, and certainly has had some great horses over the years, and has gotten some jockeys kind of on board some good horses that I would think certainly help their careers go forward. But most importantly, as I say, he's just been a nice guy and very accommodating. So, yeah, I'm with you. Wish him well on the next step in the new career.
Well, Seth, what else? We talked on Sunday. I touched on it this morning at the beginning of the show, the fallout from the nonsense in the in Riyadh. You go fishing for oil riches, and you got to deal with the consequences.
Yeah, I mean, the Mike Smith suspension, obviously, the story. And I didn't even think of it until I read his kind of comments yesterday afterwards. But with the three-day week out in Southern California, he said, hey, I'll be out a month. And it seems like, could he move his tax somewhere else? I mean, because that just seems kind of crazy. A couple hundred thousand dollars a month on the sidelines. But as you say, you go over to these different jurisdictions. I mean, we saw it happen in Dubai a few years ago with the DQ. And I'm trying to think now, the horse that ran second and they DQ'd and it was...
You're talking Brass Hat that they stole?
Yes.
They stole from Willie Martinez and Buff Bradley?
Yeah.
The most disgusting, egregious thievery that internationally in memory? Complete farce.
And that, as you said, you go over and you're dealing with a different type of an outfit. And so these things can happen. But yeah, hearkening back to that, I remember the outcry at the time. And this is, you know, the similar type of a thing.
That's don't get me started, because that's a sore point for me.
No, I remember at the time.
It was just disgusting to put Susan Roy and Wilco up to steal that money from Buff and his father and Willie. I remember at the time too saying, why would anybody even go to that? After that, followed every directive he was given in terms of in fact, and even. Added like a five day leeway of extra time for withdrawal. It did everything that they told him to do, and then they steal that money from him.
Yeah, I remember.
There you go.
It was outrageous.
Yeah. This was fun. This was this was just 20 minutes, but a hell of an appearance. Well done, Seth. Seth Merrow,
thank
everybody.
Hey, good luck to everybody today.
Seth will be here all week. Tip your servers. I got to thank David O'Connor, 2000 gold medalist and an advisor to the Fédération Équestrienne Internationale. Justin Dew with a terrific visit earlier this morning. If you missed it, Pete Fornatel as well, of course, and Sire Watch. Pedigree Focus brought to you by Hill & Dale. Replay tomorrow, 6 to 9. Archive later. Talk to you tomorrow.